Joining us now on the program is Omar Abdullah. Omar, give us a sense of why you decided to bring this fight, or rather protest or concern, to Delhi. Why not have these discussions with the Chief Minister?
Well, we haven't brought a fight, we haven't brought a protest to Delhi. We have come to register our concern about the deteriorating situation. We do not believe that it is within the control of the Chief Minister to manage what is happening there.
What does that mean? You believe the government is not in control?
No, I believe that it is for Delhi to make the necessary adjustments in its position on Jammu and Kashmir vis-a-vis what is possible and what isn't. When we acknowledge that the problem is political in nature, the solution has to be political in nature as well. It is not for the government of Jammu and Kashmir to make the concessions, because it's not within their hands. It is for the government of India to initiate a dialogue, to talk to all stakeholders, and to try and find a framework that will allow you to address this problem. And that's why we've come to Delhi.
Is that what you said to the Prime Minister today?
We said that and much more.
Give us a sense of what your main focus was in your conversation with the Prime Minister. When you say talk to all stakeholders, define all stakeholders. Do you mean, for example, the Hurriyat, or do you mean the young men out on the street armed with stones who may or may not be with the Hurriyat today?
Today those young men don't have a leadership that will talk for them.
Exactly.
So obviously you're not going to talk to all individuals there. But yes, to an extent, leaders of the Hurriyat conference represent some of their sentiment. And therefore, that's a starting point. But to
who
suggest
should hold those talks?
Well, obviously, it's going to be the government of India.
No, what I mean is, it could be a team of interlocutors.
Look, We've had interlocutors in the past. Unfortunately, their report didn't amount to much. Now, one of the options is to at least initiate some sort of dialogue around the framework of the interlocutors' report. At least own that report. Because once that report was prepared and presented to the government of India, nothing was heard of it after.
It did not even reach Parliament.
It didn't reach. And it was actually a product of Parliament. So one of the options is to at least make that a subject of discussion. But that's not going to be enough. Obviously, there are those who look for a solution beyond the four walls of the Constitution of India. Now, in the past, previous governments, both NDA 1 and UPA, have held discussions with these people, either backroom
overtly
discussions,
or overtly,
overtly
yeah.
or covertly. So, I mean, there are past models that can be followed. It's just the will that needs to be there, and that's what we thought was lacking. The fact that the impression has gone out in Jammu and Kashmir, and to an extent not unjustified, that this time this agitation is not going to be addressed politically. It's going to either be that they're either going to tire out the protesters or they're going to crush it. And
yeah,
we believe that that is fraught with all sorts of danger.
So you're saying this is not an agitation that can either be, in a sense, just prolonged till the Kashmiri people or the people out on the streets are tired, and nor can it be crushed. The fact that you think neither of these approaches...
Any agitation can be tired out. But the long-term consequences to that are really scary. Because already you have youngsters who are all set to pick up the gun. I mean, I know of youngsters who are lying in hospital injured, who are just saying, look, let me get out of here. If I can lay my hands on a weapon, I'm becoming a terrorist.
Yeah.
You know, you had a situation a few years ago where there was a glut of weapons, there weren't enough people to pick them up. Mm-hmm. Today, the reverse is true. Today, there is a glut of youngsters who are ready to become militants. The only thing they lack is weapons. Now, you need to put a check on this situation worsening, which you cannot do if you're going to use hardline tactics to try and resolve this issue.
You know, if we look at what the finance minister Arun Jaitley has said in Jammu, and these are among the strongest words I think I've heard on the situation from someone as senior as Arun Jaitley himself. He says, stone pelting protesters are stooges of Pakistan. They are not satyagrahis, these are assailants. He also said there are people who only want to see the stone pelters, and they don't want to see the injured security personnel in hospital. How do you see this statement, stone pelters are stooges of Pakistan?
I obviously will disagree with his perception of it. I'm not sure what audience he was seeking to address. He certainly wasn't trying to address the problem in Jammu and Kashmir. If anything, these sort of statements are designed to further alienate an already alienated population. One of the points that was made quite forcefully to the Prime Minister is that Jammu and Kashmir is not the place to play politics today. There are more than enough places. You have elections coming up in UP, in Punjab, in other states. By all means, play politics in those areas. Let's not do it in Jammu and Kashmir. Look at us as opposition parties. Not long ago, we were fighting elections against each other.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, an election will come up. We'll fight elections against each other again. But at least today, we have found common cause in trying to address the problem in the state today. And therefore, I respectfully would ask Mr. Arun Jaitley to please step back from this hawkish position. It doesn't help anybody. And plus, these youngsters, yes, they're alienated. Yes, the slogans that they are uttering are not slogans that he finds palatable or any Indian would find palatable. But the fact is they're not doing it at anybody's behest. They're not being paid to do it. They're doing it because it's their own sentiment. You know, the mistake we are making is to try and pin the blame on Pakistan for everything that is going wrong in Jammu and Kashmir today. Look, Pakistan has fished in troubled waters. Militancy is their product, we agree. The last 25 years, my party, more than any other political party, has been targeted by militants that have originated from across the line of control. But this current agitation that arose after the death of Burhan Wani is not the product of Pakistan. Yes, they have fished in troubled waters. Yes, they have tried to internationalize this current agitation, but it is not of their making.
But you know, you have the NIA, for example, announcing that they're going to investigate a fund flow into the valley in the last 3 weeks, which they believe they're looking at 10 bank accounts. They say this money is being channeled from Pakistan. I might agree with your impression on the ground, but this is the position the NIA has taken. This is the position the Home Minister has taken. This is the position the Finance Minister has taken.
Sure. So when you have the evidence, when you arrest the people, when you show us the front trail, sure. Look, I'm not saying that Pakistan is not fishing in troubled waters. And is this the first time Pakistan is sending money to Jammu and Kashmir? For the last 25 years, they have done it. I'm sure there are any number of suspicious bank accounts over the last 25 years. But when we start trying to blame Pakistan for everything that is wrong in Jammu and Kashmir today, we are living in denial, because then we don't believe that the solution lies within our boundaries. We believe that the solution lies in Islamabad, which is not true.
Would you say this street agitation is entirely indigenous and Pakistan has no role in it?
I would say that the origins are indigenous. Subsequently, yes, Pakistan has fished in troubled waters, but it is not of their making. It is not of their control. Look, if they were in a position to engineer agitations like this, why couldn't they do a better job engineering boycotts of elections then? If they can engineer lakhs of people participating in funerals, why can they not engineer lakhs of people staying away from elections? Why is it that after 2010, you had some of the most peaceful years in Jammu and Kashmir? Look, Pakistan has always been interested in trouble in the state. So if they were able to create this sort of an environment without any assistance from us, why didn't they do it in 2011, in 2012, in the immediate aftermath of Afzal Guru's execution? Why didn't Afzal Guru's execution see a similar 44-day uprising that you're seeing today?
Why do you think, though, because, I mean, I've traveled a fair bit in the valley, and one sees, which one doesn't show on TV, but one does see Pakistani flags at some of the janazas, at some of the funeral processions. I asked one young boy, I said, why do you do this? He said, just to irritate you guys, right? So there's a little bit of, we're cocking a snook at you. But beyond that, we've also seen a ratcheting up on the other side of the border. We've seen Nawaz Sharif making the kind of statements on Kashmir that he hasn't made in the last decade. Why is that happening?
He's also playing to a domestic constituency. I mean, if Arun Jaitley can play to his constituency in Jammu, please note, I mean, that speech of his was made in Jammu. So, I mean, he's addressing the BJP core constituency in Jammu. I mean, why would you expect Nawaz Sharif not to do the same? Of course, Nawaz Sharif has a constituency, and his constituency is even more threatened because of the even stronger role that the army seems to be playing there. So he's trying to address his own domestic constituency, looking at what's happening in Jammu and Kashmir, as unfortunately some of the ruling establishment here is doing.
Let's come back to what you said. You said this is not, we told the Prime Minister, this is not the time to play party politics. The PDP, however, accuses you and your party of doing exactly that. You know, they
by
say,
doing what? By coming here and asking for a political dialogue? It's in their agenda for alliance.
They
it's
asked, why didn't you come for their all-party meeting?
Because there's nothing that they can give us. And I'll flip that question on its head then. Why didn't they come for the all-party meeting in 2010? At least give us the credit of being here only espousing the cause of Jammu and Kashmir. We're not here for our own chairs. In no meeting have we suggested that Mehbooba Mufti should be replaced. Even though, if there is any person I hold responsible for the situation today, it is her. It is her complete mishandling of the situation that has brought us to this point. But even then, I am not demanding her dismissal or replacement.
What would you have had her do instead? What would you have, since you do hold her responsible, what would you have had her do instead or differently?
I think the first 48 to 72 hours after Burhan Wani's death were critical, and those were the ones that were mishandled. And after that, things have been made worse. She doesn't seem to know which side of the line she's on. She doesn't know whether she wants to govern or wants to be in opposition. So she gives one set of instructions to one set of officers and countermands them by giving another set to another. Even in her own head, she's not clear whether the Burhan Wani encounter was necessary or not necessary. So she wants to be both the ruling establishment as well as the opposition. In situations like this, when there is no clear command being given within the administration, obviously there's going to be a problem. So she has compounded the mess that has been made there. But even then, if we had followed the PDP's example, I would have been here in Delhi lobbying for the replacement of Mehbooba Mufti, which is the one thing we have not lobbied
And
for.
Why have you not done that?
Because we believe that it is only fit that she be around to resolve this problem. Our job is to try and supplement the efforts of the government by putting what we believe is the correct perspective in front of the powers that be in Delhi.
But, you know, you saw BJP leader Ram Madhav, who's the author of, or one of the authors of this alliance between the PDP and the BJP, going on Twitter and saying, you know, these people, obviously referring to you, who talk about all this, they don't have any solutions. And then he's also raised, why didn't your party attend the Independence Day functions, whether in Srinagar or across the valley? How do you see that?
Well, wasn't in
it was seen as a boycott
it.
Of sorts.
It wasn't a boycott. There is no organized system of attending or not attending. It's not as if this is the first time that a former chief minister has not come for the 15th August function. To my memory, in none of the 6 years that I was chief minister did Mufti Sayyid attend the 15th August function. So why are you judging us by different standards? Judge us by the same standards that you judge your own allies by. If Mufti Sayyid's presence was not required for 6 years in Jammu and Kashmir when I was chief minister, why suddenly is my absence being noted? It was not an organized boycott. I wasn't in Srinagar. I didn't attend. That's the end of the story. Now, as far as, again, Ram Madhav has a constituency to address. He's addressing it. I have no sort of
But if everybody's going to keep addressing their own constituencies, how are
That's the point that we made to the Prime Minister. The time has come to step back. Look, we're not addressing our constituencies. I'm not here espousing the cause of autonomy, even though that is the National Conference's stated position on the solution. All we are doing is espousing the cause of dialogue. After that, when the dialogue starts, of course, individual parties will take their own individual lines. But let's at least agree that there is a political problem that needs to be resolved politically.
The Prime Minister, one of the problems that you had with his speech, not on 15th August, but even before that, when he spoke about the Azadi that all Indians enjoy is available to the people of Jammu and Kashmir as well. You said one of your disappointments was that he spoke through the development prism. Is it true that today the Prime Minister acknowledged that the problem in Kashmir cannot be resolved only through the development?
He said as much. He said that development alone is not the solution to this problem.
And what did you seek from the Prime Minister in this meeting?
The acceptance of the political nature of the problem and the need for a long-term, sustained, meaningful political dialogue.
Did you get that acknowledgement?
Look, it's not for me to speak for the Prime Minister because I don't want to say something that tomorrow will put the Prime Minister's office in a position where they have to issue a clarification. Let's just say that the fact that the Prime Minister acknowledged that development alone is not the solution is, to my mind, a step forward from previous positions that were taken that we will develop our way out of this problem.
But, you know, you did talk about being disappointed at the Independence Day speech focusing on Balochistan and not making any mention of Kashmir. How do you read this tectonic, because it is a tectonic shift in the approach to Pakistan? You know, now BJP is saying don't link Balochistan to Kashmir, but the first time we heard the reference was at the all-party meeting.
Well, it has been linked. When you talk about POK and Balochistan in the same sentence, you have effectively linked the two. You have linked them. I'm not yet able to understand what the need was to do this at this point in time. I understand where it stems from. I understand the thought process and the architect of this, but I'm not sure I understand the timing of it because you open yourself up to all sorts of criticism.
Like
when your own part of Jammu and Kashmir is burning today, when you have touching on 70 deaths and 44 days of restrictions, you have a lot to answer for your own internal handling of Jammu and Kashmir. How are you going to point fingers at other people? I can understand if Kashmir was completely peaceful and there was no problem here and then you wanted to fish in other people's troubled waters, that's a different matter. But your own house is on fire today. Rather than putting out the fire in your own home, you're busy trying to set fire to your neighbor's home.
But isn't it true that Pakistan has always tried to internationalize Kashmir? It's focused on, you know, issues of democracy, of human rights violations here. And therefore, it is kosher for India to say, who are you to say that to us? Look what's happening in your own house.
We've always said that. We've always said that. Come on, when have we not pointed out the problems within Pakistan? We have done.
But Baluchistan, we've never really gone this far to
I agree.
To talk about it publicly.
Of course, that's why you called it a Teutonic
shift.
You
think it's a mistake?
No, I'm not going to say it's a mistake. I am saying that the timing perhaps leaves much to be desired. Because, as I said, you open yourself up to criticism. When your own part of Jammu and Kashmir today is so troubled. The United Nations Secretary General has made not one but at least two references to the trouble in Jammu and Kashmir. Internationally, we are taking a hammering for what's happening, and I can understand why. At this point in time, to open a new front on Balochistan, it does create problems for us. Look, let's solve the problem of the part of Jammu and Kashmir that we have right now. Then we can go looking for trouble elsewhere.
Did you bring up the use of pellet guns in your meeting with the Prime Minister?
In the memorandum, there was a mention of it.
14% of all pellet gun injuries are below the age of 15. Many of them, like little Insha, whom we've met here, are teenagers, they're kids. Mehbooba Mufti on that says, what are children doing out in conflict? Parents need to keep children at home.
Which is true. I mean, of course, what are children doing out in that conflict? But then they're angry. And they're not within the control of their parents.
Teenagers, little kids.
Look, it's genuine anger. They're not there for fun. Do you know anybody who's willing to take a blast from a pellet gun out of a thrill? They're doing it because there's genuine anger. Burhan Wani was the trigger, but there are other reasons behind it. And these 15-year-olds, 14-year-olds, excuse me, aren't agitating because they want a job. They're agitating because something else has made them really angry, and that anger we're refusing to acknowledge. See, therein again lies the problem with Mehbooba Mufti's handling. Everybody else is at fault but her. The National Conference is at fault, we're fanning the flames. The Congress is at fault, we're trying to replace her. The administration has failed, the police has failed. Parents are responsible because they're not keeping control of their children. Everybody else is to blame, but Mehbooba Mufti is blameless. How can you have a situation like this, where the head of the government is completely blameless, but everybody else is at fault?
Firstly, on children, do you believe that there is some merit to her saying that parents need to keep their children at home, or do you believe that puts the onus of the injuries on the parents?
I am the father of teenagers. I know that there is a point beyond which you cannot control children. Mehbooba is the mother of teenagers. She knows that children after a point are not within the control of their parents. And I'm sorry to say this. I mean, the anger that the children feel is also the anger in the parents. Has it occurred to Mehbooba that maybe the parents don't want to stop the children? Has it occurred to Mehbooba that maybe the parents actually feel an active part of this? I mean, you don't turn a blind eye to the situation on the ground there. You had a minister in her government trying to sort of minimize the scale of the protest, that only 5% people were out there.
Sajjad knows.
This is a damn sight, more than 5% of the people.
He also said, he also spoke about the protest not necessarily being spontaneous. He said nothing in Kashmir is spontaneous. He said only 5% of people are out on the streets. And then he said separatists have children. Why aren't their children out on the streets? Suggesting thereby... separatists sit at home.
That
was his allegation.
I'm really glad that 6 years has added so much wisdom to his understanding of the situation. I don't know where this wisdom was in 2010, because he certainly didn't see the situation like this then. See his YouTube videos, his statements. He had a completely different understanding of Kashmir up until his meeting with Mr. Narendra Modi and subsequent sort of tie-up with the BJP. So this delayed onset of wisdom is quite a welcome development, and I'd like to see it happen to other people.
He accused you and the Congress of having created Burhan Wani. He said the National Conference had walked over.
I'm not getting into that.
A thousand dead bodies to reach where you are.
If I get into what Sajjad might or might not have created, there's no end to this. So I'll get one of my party spokespersons to adequately answer.
So let's come back to the pellet guns. And the reason I bring that up is because the CRPF tells the Jammu and Kashmir High Court 1.3 million pellets is what it actually adds up to. But they say if we didn't have these guns, we'd actually have to use bullets, and therefore the casualties would be higher. This is their response.
I get that. It's not just the weapon. It's how it's used also. Look, any weapon can be a lethal weapon if it's not used properly. My worry is that not only are you deploying pellet guns in the numbers that you are, you're also handing them over to people who have no idea how to use them. And that's why you have a far greater number today of injuries and casualties than you've had in the past. So, I mean, for the CRPF to take the line that these guns are necessary is one part of it. But then they also need to adequately address the concern that these guns are also being handed over to people that have absolutely no idea how to use them.
The BJP PDP says that these guns were first acquired in 2010 when you were still chief minister, not used in en masse because they were still being acquired, but that they were requisitioned then. And so therefore, their accusation is that you have belatedly developed problems with their use.
When there's a car accident, do you blame the owner of the car or the driver of the car? These guns are currently with the state government. If it was within my purview to bring them in, why is it not within the purview of the chief minister to take them out? I mean, something is wrong somewhere. If a chief minister can introduce these weapons, why can a chief minister not then order their disuse? Clearly, either I was not responsible for bringing them in, which means Mehbooba is not empowered to stop their use, or then the PDP is basically trying to muddy the waters and shift the blame away from them. The fact is that it is their government that has used these weapons, used them in a way in which they're not supposed to be used, and the consequences are in front of you.
Omar, talk a little bit about why 2016 is so different from 2010, where you actually can't find a way to frame this in terms of justice, because it is about a militant who was taken out.
See, 2008, if you see, the agitation started because of the economic blockade of Kashmir. 2010 was because of the Matsil fake encounter, which was then compounded by the death of Tufail Mattu, and things went from bad to worse after that. 2016 is not about justice, it's not about an economic blockade. There really isn't anything that these protesters are actually asking for. It seems to be purely an expression of rage, of anger, maybe even disappointment. And the fact that the protests have largely been focused in South Kashmir, which is the bastion of the PDP, in itself will perhaps tell us something. And I think you can't divorce yourself from the fact that the sentiments that the PDP played up in the run-up to the assembly elections, demonizing the BJP, demonizing the RSS, calling for a mandate for Kashmir, and then turning that on its head and tying up with the same party that they demonized not so long ago. I think even that has reflected itself in...
You're saying the alliance itself is a trigger for the anger?
I'm saying that that it has played a part in this. And that shows in the geographical spread of the protests. I can assure you that if you scratch below the surface and see, you will find that people who until yesterday were card-carrying members of the PDP are amongst those who have been injured or were still killed in this protest.
There is one school of thought. It comes from a number of Kashmiri Pandit leaders. It comes from some BJP leaders who talk about this rage actually being Islamist in nature. And I will tell you that one separatist whom I can't name did say to me that he feels today he has to talk about Muslim identity much more than he did earlier, because he thinks that young men today are also seeing this entire unrest through the prism of their religion being under siege. Now, do you sense a kind of Islamism element in the anger on the street?
Well, there is, and it's not a new phenomenon. We've seen this sort of creeping in for the last quite some years now. But even then, the slogans that you hear uttered on the streets today are not Islamic slogans in nature. They are slogans for Azadi. The flag that you see fluttering around is not the ISIS flag. It's the flag of Pakistan. So even though, yes, there are sort of the elements creeping in that you're talking about, I think the overwhelming sentiment is still political in nature, not religious.
So when Muzaffar Beg comes to the all-party meeting and says the ISIS ideology could take root here in the valley, what would you say to that?
Yeah, but then he also contradicted himself and said Kashmiris are today willing to pick up the gun for two sets of kurta pajamas. which I think is I mean, I can't imagine a worse statement coming from somebody who had been deputy chief minister, because it shows a complete lack of understanding of what these people are willing to do. Nobody is going to kill themselves for two kurta pajamas. Yeah.
But do you believe the ISIS ideology as he claims? He said if
I have seen no evidence of it so far, other than the handful of flags that come out on Friday, again, as that young fellow told you, just to irritate all of you and to get a bit of play in some TV studios. I haven't seen evidence of it.
How serious is radicalism as a concern for you? Among these,
well, obviously
men.
It's a concern, but then it's not unique to Jammu and Kashmir. It's not unique to Islam. You see increased radicalism cutting across religions in this country today. When the majority community can be so radicalized, do you expect the minorities will not follow suit? Of course they would.
What do you elaborate on that? What do you mean when the majority community can be so radicalized?
It doesn't need elaboration. You've seen far more radical expressions of opinion in the country over the last couple of years, and there will obviously be a reaction from other communities as well.
When this unrest is on and Amnesty International organizes a seminar in Bangalore, Azadi slogans are raised and a sedition charge is booked, and the Congress with whom you went as part of the delegation today appears confused on how really to process that. How do you see that? Because to my mind, if slogans are going to be the basis for sedition, you'll have to shut down large chunks, more than 5% of the Kashmir Valley today, with sedition.
No, which is true. But then, just sloganeering on its own is not sedition. Unless what you're saying encourages violence and actually gives rise to violence. Just a slogan on its own is not sedition. And I think Indian democracy is strong enough to handle a handful of slogans, yeah.
So you don't think Amnesty International should have been booked for sedition?
I think we know what Amnesty International stands for. And all they were doing was trying to sort of make the case for those who have been victims of state violence. Now, we can agree or disagree, but I don't think we need to chase them out from here. The problem with us is that we seem to have very thin skin when it comes to criticism on these lines. We're quite happy to hold the mirror up for other countries to take a look at. We want to remind Pakistan of its failings. We want to remind Sri Lanka of its failings. We want to preach democracy to Nepal. And we want to go out with our own models of assistance and all the rest of it. But when it comes to somebody holding up a mirror to us and saying, look, this is what you've done wrong, then suddenly we have no appetite to hear it. Look, in 25 years of trouble in Jammu and Kashmir, are you telling me that there have been no incidences or excesses on the part of the security forces? There must have been. So what is wrong if somebody holds up a mirror and says, look, this is where you were wrong.
Well,
learn from it.
There is question that they're funded from outside, they focus only one part of the story, they're lopsided. That's what the...
So then you put the other side of the story out. Amnesty International doesn't hold a brief for the Indian security forces. Fine, we know that. Government of India does. So Government of India will put its side of the story out. But again, I mean, when we sort of chase these people out, we're sending a message out to the wider world that we are unwilling to listen, that somehow we are so ashamed of our track record that if we're even reminded of it, we are going to shut down those voices.
So you're saying we can't quite talk about Pakistan's atrocities in Balochistan if we're scared of Azadi slogans at an Amnesty seminar?
If those Azadi slogans were actually going to result in Azadi, sure, then you should be afraid. But come on, a handful of slogans in Bangalore, give those guys credit. I mean, they're doing it in Bangalore. They're not doing it in Jammu and Kashmir. I mean, I think it takes guts to go down to sort of the rest of the country and actually utter slogans like this. They know that their slogans aren't going to amount to much. They've done it. It's fine. This is democracy. We don't like what they're saying. But let them say it. It's fine.
You said you're not raising autonomy at the moment, even though that is the official plank of the national conference. It makes me wonder, when you say this time to the Prime Minister, to the President, we need talks, what have attempts like this, and maybe I've just become cynical, achieved previously? Your party had an autonomy resolution. It went into the dustbin of history, quite frankly. You had an interlocutor's report. It never reached Parliament. You had an all-party delegation last time. It managed to de-escalate, but it didn't amount to much. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we restart the cycle. There is some new bunch of interlocutors, or maybe even the old one. They go, they even meet with the Hurriyat conference. Then what? What are
Look,
we...
You know,
it's history repeating itself.
I get that, and that's a question I've often asked myself. But the problem with that is that then if we give up, Then what's the point? Then everything is hopeless. We have to somehow be able to convince ourselves that, okay, if not last time, then this time, that better sense will prevail, that somewhere somebody will learn from mistakes and decide that mistakes will not be repeated. Look, this prime minister has a mandate that previous prime ministers didn't have. And I reminded him of that. Look, neither Dr. Manmohan Singh nor Atal Bihari Vajpayee had the sort of mandate this prime minister has. This prime minister's mandate has been reinforced by the sort of support that he got on the issue of Jammu and Kashmir from other parties in parliament and in that all-party meeting. This is not the sort of mandate that needs to be wasted. And this prime minister has also shown himself to be somebody who's willing to take risks. Calling Nawaz Sharif for his swearing-in so soon after a militant attack in Jammu. It was a risk, but he took it. The Ufa declaration, it was a risk, he took it. More than that, dropping in unannounced to meet Nawaz Sharif in Lahore, a huge risk, but he took it. Now, if he can take risks like that with Pakistan, how about a risk or two with regard to Jammu and Kashmir?
Do you think maybe he's breaking from the pattern, saying, I'm going to do it differently, we are going to be hardline, we are going to be hawkish, as was manifest perhaps in the statements of Arun Jaitley, who said there will be no compromise with people who are violent?
In which case, then you will lose the people. You will keep the land, but you will lose the people, and you have to be willing to accept that. You can't win the people by hawkish stands. Yes, there is a time and there is a place for hawkishness. Yes, you can't deal with terrorists the same way you will deal with agitators. But if you're going to deal with everybody from a hawkish point of view and say, look, we are going to crush this agitation, we are going to squash it, and we don't care how many people die along the way, then if for the next couple of generations you lose the people of Jammu and Kashmir, don't blame me. Because all I can do is try and point out the risks to you. If you're unwilling to accept those, then I'm sorry, I failed, but at least I gave it my best shot.
You have said in Parliament and even outside of it that Jammu and Kashmir did not merge with India. It was an accession based on a set of conditions, and those conditions have actually never been met. Does that mean that you believe that this is something that can be reversed?
No, I've not talked about the reversal of accession. I've talked about historical facts, and if anything, these historical facts were further sort of reinforced by Dr. Karan Singh when he spoke on similar lines in the second parliament debate in the Rajya Sabha. It is a historical fact that Jammu and Kashmir acceded to India. When it acceded to India, the union was responsible only for currency, defense, and foreign affairs. Since then, that position has been whittled away. So, while you've expected Jammu and Kashmir to uphold its side of the bargain by staying with India, you've gradually chipped away at us at the other side.
So, do you subscribe to the theory that there can be no peace accord without going back to the pre-1953 position?
Look, I'm not getting into individual party lines here, because look, you know what my party's point of view is. But yeah, this is not the time, nor I suppose is this the place, for us to espouse individual political party lines. There are different party points of view, right from ours to the PDP's, to the Congress, to the BJP, which talks about the complete merger of Jammu and Kashmir into India. When a political dialogue takes place, when a political dialogue takes place, of course we will talk on the lines that our parties mandate us to. But at this point in time, all we want is the acknowledgement or the acceptance that this is a political problem.
Did you get any assurance from the Prime Minister that such a dialogue would take place?
Again, it's not for me to speak for the Prime Minister. Whatever the Prime Minister wants to convey, one hopes that he will convey himself. I mean, I can only tell you what we sort of asked of him.
Now, before Burhan Wani was actually taken out, there were several issues that had become the basis for big debate in the Jammu and Kashmir Assembly, also lightning rod for rage on the streets of the valley. Return of pandits, whether they should come home in separate enclaves, Sene colonies, and so on. Now, Mehbooba Mufti issues a statement today saying vested interest first fueled unrest in Handwara, and then they did so by talking about things like separate colonies. You were charged by the PDP of having first chaired the meetings of the Sainik boards. How do you see the entire issue of Sainik colonies? Because, Omar, it could also be argued. It could also be argued that these are citizens of Jammu.
Sure, and we had no problem with that.
The
moment the Chief Minister got up in the Assembly and clarified the government's position on the Sainik colonies, have you seen us mention it after that?
No, I haven't. Exactly. Not since the Assembly.
Exactly. So that's it. The matter was addressed by the Chief Minister, which is all we wanted. And the matter was closed.
Do you support or oppose these colonies? The only
concern we had was to ensure that safeguards were put into place so that the state subject laws were not diluted. The Chief Minister gave us that assurance. Matter was closed. We did not fuel the flames in Handwara. I'd like to see the chief minister point out a single piece of evidence that would suggest that we were the ones who fueled the flames in Handwara. Look, the problem is the chief minister is in a habit of blaming people from time to time and then turning to those very same people for support. Throughout the summer, the chief minister justified the detention and the arrest of the Hurriyat conference leaders. She said, I have to save my tourist season. I'm not going to let these people out. In the winter, I'll see what has to be done. No sooner had Burhan Wani been killed that she appeals to the same separatists who all summer she had detained and said, no, please come and help me. I'm in trouble. I mean, again, it points to that double speak on the part of Mehbooba Mufti. She doesn't know where she stands on any particular issue. And that's why her government is confused.
You asked for a judicial commission of inquiry to be set up. A similar inquiry was in fact set up in 2010 when you were chief minister and 120 I think boys were killed after clashes. That inquiry commission has yet to produce any meaningful result. What would another judicial commission of inquiry do?
Well, that the terms of reference for that were very clear. It was the 2010. It's an ongoing inquiry. It's for the state government. I've been out of office now for going on more than a year and a half.
Yeah.
And therefore obviously it's for the state government today to answer to it. Yes. We were from time to time asked for extensions against my better judgment. We were forced to, because if we had not extended the term of it and we had sort of asked them to conclude their report, it would have looked incomplete. And then somebody would have said this was a whitewash. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it was but natural that we would have to give the commission as much time as it requires. Unfortunately, this is not the first commission in this country that has taken an inordinate amount of time.
So what would another
conclude.
One do?
Well, obviously, it will look into the current circumstances, and perhaps this government will be a little tougher on timelines. It's for the government of the day to now decide what they want to do.
Explain to people who don't understand Jammu and Kashmir why issues like the return of pandits to separate colonies, as many of them want, or Sainik colonies for state citizens, why have these issues become such flashpoints for anger?
Well, they haven't. The point of disagreement on the Pandit return was simply this, that look, enclaves, separate enclaves for them within the valley, it goes against our ethos. We would like, at least not in the immediate instance, but over time, for them to assimilate back into the population as far as possible, go back to places where they came from. Transit accommodation, nobody has had any problems with. I myself was the architect of a few transit camps in my government, but permanent enclaves for them is something that we think goes against the very ethos of Kashmir. I mean, that's all we've said. We've never raised objections to them coming back. If anything, we have always been advocates of the return of all those who left, whether Kashmiri Pandits, Kashmiri Sikhs, Kashmiri Muslims. There are still Muslims who are living away from their villages in the hills of Doda, Rajouri, Poonch, etc. So cutting across religious lines, people have had to leave. We want them all to come back. And obviously in this, the Kashmiri Pandits have sort of borne a huge brunt of the trouble. And sooner rather than later, we'd like to see them back. On the Sainik colony issue, the simple question we had was about the safeguards that the state subject laws should not be diluted. As I said earlier, once that question was addressed, matter closed as far as we are concerned.
Talk a little bit about the response, and I thought quite an extraordinary response, of the Northern Army commander, who in a pretty unprecedented statement says, let's step back, let's everybody talk, forces, government, separatists, students, let's all sit down at the table together. Now, typically, this should not be the army's job. I mean, he was actually saying probably
well,
what
I think
we would
unfortunately,
have...
he had to say it because nobody else in authority was saying it. These are the words that should have come from the defense minister or even higher.
How did you see his statement?
Well, I think it was a very brave statement. And I hope he hasn't had to face the consequences of it, because, again, we seem to be a little intolerant to words that we're uncomfortable with. I hope his words have been taken in the right spirit and actually taken seriously. Because when people like us say it, we're looked at anti-national sellouts, Pakistani stooges, etc., etc. Anything that I say that the rest of the country doesn't particularly like is seen as being anti-national. But, I mean, at the end of the day, Lieutenant General Huda is a senior decorated army officer. He's anything but anti-national. So when he says things like that, I hope people sit up and take notice.
the criticism that has come from, let's say, an Arun Jaitley, that why doesn't Omar Abdullah talk about security personnel? Why doesn't he, you know, for example, you did, of course, on your Twitter page, condemn what happened with the death of the lecturer, and we all did. And General Huda himself got up and said, this is absolutely unjustified, the beating of those villages. It was horrifying to see it, and there was relief in the fact that the army commander owned that and said, this is a mistake and it can't happen again. But Omar, there are local Kashmiri policemen today whom I have met who are terrified to even tell their names, who are being singled out by Burhan Wani's so-called successor, Zakir Bhatt, whom Syed Ali Shah Gilani named one particular police officer. Does the National Conference speak for them as Kashmiris?
We speak for everybody. We speak for the entire state of Jammu and Kashmir. Look, we want this problem to end because we understand that there is growing anger on both sides. If the stone pelters and the agitators are angry, even the security forces from time to time are responding out of anger. Aripanthan in my constituency would not have happened if the security forces had not gone there in a charged up mood.
You believe that that's...
I sincerely believe that is...
This is just to set in perspective for viewers. This is a village in your constituency where four civilians die. The CRPF says they were attacked with petrol bombs. You believe that it was excessive
I believe that the security forces went up there in a charged up mindset. And look...
And did what? Because
you see the consequences.
No, I've seen it. I went there. But they claim that they were attacked. You're saying you don't buy that.
No, I'm saying that security forces, patience is wearing thin. Yeah. And because their patience is wearing thin, you are having incidents like Aripanthan, you having incidents like Crew. God forbid, there will be other incidents like this in the future. So when we talk about dialing down, when we talk about calm being restored, obviously, the general population benefits, but even the security forces get a breather.
So just to clarify, you believe what happened in Crew, which the general has admitted himself, but you also believe what happened in Budgam was an excessive use of force and was not in retaliation to hundreds of protesters charging at the CRPF, which is what they claim.
I'm sure there were protesters, because obviously you had to shoot at somebody. Yeah. But what brought those protesters out? My understanding is that certain excesses on the part of the security forces actually agitated that population enough to come out and protest. Because otherwise, it is inexplicable to me that an area that was largely calm for 40 odd days of this 45-day agitation should suddenly rise up. I mean, if that anger was there, why didn't it manifest itself in the first day after Burhan Wani's death? Why 40 days later? Obviously, something happened on the ground there. Something happened that agitated those people.
I want to talk in the end about the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is that what's happening on the streets of the Kashmir Valley, nobody might be in control. My impression is nobody's in control. Nobody can turn this on and off. What does this mean for the relevance of the mainstream parties, the Valley parties today, when even the separatists might not be in control?
Well, it's a fact that the separatists are not in complete control of this. Whether publicly they're willing to acknowledge it or not, privately I'm sure some of them would be willing to acknowledge that they're not in complete control of the situation. But that doesn't make them irrelevant to the situation any more than it makes us irrelevant. Sure, our constituency has shrunk today. It'd be foolish on my part to deny that. But to suggest that because there is trouble on the streets, we are irrelevant, would then be to suggest that when peace is restored and normalcy returns, then the Hurriyat Conference becomes irrelevant. They're not. In normal times, the Hurriyat Conference continues to enjoy relevance to the situation, as we do in these times, because we speak for a different constituency. Perhaps our outlook is different, but our relevance to the situation does not change.
So unlike a Sajjad loan, you see this as a mass protest and a spontaneous one?
Certainly. I wouldn't say that it's 100% spontaneous. Perhaps a percent here or there may be manipulated, but I definitely don't see it as just 5% of the population, because if it was only 5% of the population, believe me, we wouldn't be in a position where most of us wouldn't even be able to go to our constituencies.
It is that bad.
I don't think there is a single mainstream politician today who can visit their constituency and actually be able to talk to people there.
So against the backdrop of this, Omar, to end, set this against the raging debate around nationalism. And I ask this because even Arun Jaitley spoke about it, Amit Shah has spoken about it, Ram Madhav has spoken about it. There are channels like a Times Now or NewsX that have a very, very, very different position from, let's say, the one I may have on Jammu and Kashmir. again framed within nationalism. This nationalism debate, how is this playing out on the streets of the valley? You know, when you juxtapose the two.
Look, I honestly, I wouldn't be able to answer that. Because
politically, there's never been such a sort of shrill assertion and a hard definition of nationalism.
But then the results are in front of you, aren't they? Today, in 44 days, you have 70 odd dead, thousands injured. Obviously, this is in reaction to something. You can't keep thrusting your version of nationalism down people's throats and expect there won't be a reaction. Look, that's why I keep saying you can't just own the land, you have to own the people. So therefore, by crushing what is happening on the streets there and saying this is in our national interest, sure, you'll retain the land. You won't retain the people. How is alienating such a significant chunk of your population in your national interest? It can't be. I mean, how can driving 8-year-old, 10-year-olds to attack police stations be in your national interest? Look, let's understand that there is a reason for this anger. And let's answer it. Let's not shy away from it. Let's not bury our heads in the sand. You throw out an Amnesty International. You ban a couple of newspapers or channels from broadcasting. You stop people from speaking. But is that addressing the national cause?
Your one word of unsolicited advice to Mehbooba Mufti, who has said, and let me quote this to you: if you want to protest, why send out children? Why burn police stations? These are people who create unrest and then run away, leaving the children to face it. Police stations burned. Is there a point to the fact that the crowd protesting today is much more violent, has changed the tactics of protest?
I would suggest that the scale and intensity of violence today is less than it was in 2010. If you see the intensity of protests, the actual damage to government properties in 2010, if you talk to your colleagues in Srinagar today, they will tell you that a lot more damage was done to public property in 2010 than it is today. I can't think of a single railway station that has been burnt today. We had railway stations burnt in 2010. So in terms of the actual scale, I would suggest that Mehbooba Mufti actually isn't dealing with as much as I was. But I wasn't looking for excuses at that time. I owned up to, and I own up even today. If I hadn't made mistakes in 2010, the situation wouldn't have reached the point where it did. But I learned from those mistakes. The biggest tragedy for me today is not only have the government of the day refused to learn from my mistakes, they're repeating them and they're actually worsening it. If they could only learn from the mistakes I had made, we wouldn't have been in this situation today.
What's the one biggest mistake you made that you think she might be repeating today?
Oh God, I think it's too late for that now.
What was your biggest mistake?
I didn't understand the scale of the problem in the beginning. If I had adequately understood the scale of the problem when Tufail Mattu died, I would not have allowed the protests to spread as wide as they did. I underestimated the reaction of people at that time. I didn't take adequate measures. I didn't adequately identify myself with the sentiments that prevailed on the streets at that time. And the state paid a very heavy price for it.
And underestimation could be lethal once again.
No, we have underestimated.
Yeah.
It's because we underestimated everything and now are looking to blame everybody else for our problems that we are where we are today.
We leave it there, Omar. We hope the Prime Minister took away something from your meeting with him this morning and that we will see something of the unrest getting at least contained, if not better. Thank you so much for talking to us in the Watch Top Secret.